Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 5th, 2005. Today's session, Undoing Creation, Species Extinction. Presented by Philip Moat in the Fireside Room. Disc number MOP-2005-05. Let's listen in.
Earlier talks in the week. Thanks for coming. This is, thank you. This is about Species Extinction, Undoing Creation. I work at the University of Washington as a climate scientist, and I'm not a biologist, so this is merely a layman's view, but much of what I base this talk on is this book, The Future of Life, by Edward O. Wilson. I'll introduce you to him in a minute. This book is available in the bookstore, and I really enjoyed reading it the first time. Very, very interesting. That's why I decided to include that as the last in this series. So the talks that I've done so far this week on different types of global environmental problems, we started out with problems that are essentially solved, acid rain and ozone depletion, then 3 days on the issue of climate change, and now finally species extinctions. Just a quick recap, this is a map of acid rain, or more specifically the acidity of various kinds of fresh water. The greens are basically fine, and the reds here in the Northeast are places where there was a great deal of concern in 1994. Through legislation, the Clean Air Act, this has largely been improved. The ozone hole is a very dramatic, unexpected example of human influence on the environment. This is the quantity of ozone above Antarctica in October of each year, and starting around 1970, this natural level was sort of left behind, and we had this series of ever lower quantities of ozone. This is a picture of the ozone hole here taken by satellite. These numbers have sort of leveled off in recent years, but it's likely to take a while to recover. But again, through policies, the culprits in ozone depletion were essentially eliminated, the chlorofluorocarbons. They're still floating around in the atmosphere, and it'll take a while to flush them out. Then the climate change issue, we have dramatically altered the composition of Earth's atmosphere. This is the amount of carbon dioxide taken from bubbles of gas trapped in ice cores that indicate that for thousands of years, actually, before this diagram, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was quite constant. And then we started digging things out of the ground, coal, oil, and natural gas, and burning them. And that altered the natural balance of carbon dioxide, and so we're now 32% above pre-industrial levels. Well, what are the recovery times of these different issues? Well, for acid rain, once you eliminate the source of the acidity in the atmosphere, the lakes and streams would flush out within a matter of a decade or so. So acid rain is a fairly rapidly solvable problem. The ozone layer will probably take about 50 to 100 years to fully recover now that we've basically stopped producing CFCs. This is simply because the CFCs themselves have a very long residence time in the atmosphere, so it takes a long time for them to be eliminated. Carbon dioxide, this altering of the geological cycle of carbon means that after we stabilize emissions at a fairly low level, it will still take probably 10,000 or more years for the carbon dioxide amounts to return to that pre-industrial level of 280 parts per million. So these are ever-increasing timescales, and for species loss, this was a kid at Holden last year, extinction is forever. So there is essentially no recovery time for species loss, and that's why I've left this one for last. It's, in a sense, the worst of the environmental problems, because for every step that we take down this path, there's no going back, unlike with these atmospheric problems. So this is E.O. Wilson. He's now retired. He's in his 80s. He was a biology professor at Harvard and the honorary curator in entomology at the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard, one of the finest museums of zoology in the world. His specialty was ants, insects, and soil microbes. But he got interested in this issue of what makes species thrive or die, and he was actually the one who coined the term biodiversity, which is now in very common use. This was one of a long series of very readable public books that he's written in addition to his scholarly efforts. He talks about, and he wasn't the first to come up with this, the five human threats to species: habitat destruction, invasive species, pollution, population, the sheer numbers of humanity, and over-harvesting. As you can see, they form the helpful acronym HIPPO. So he talks about, you know, the human beings being sort of a hippo rampaging across the landscape. So we're going to go through each of these, but we aren't going to say anything about population because that's sort of obvious, and it really drives all of the others. We're actually going to take these in reverse order, starting with over-harvesting and ending. Actually, we're not going to say much about pollution either. So let's go to over-harvesting. There were a number of examples, and when we were talking about climate change, it was largely the developed world that was at fault. You know, 75% of current emissions are by the small fraction of humanity that lives in developed countries. By contrast, a lot of these issues are more equally spread across the globe. So a lot of really shameful examples of over-harvesting occurred when early humans arrived in Australia, where a lot of species then went extinct, and the Americas, roughly, so Australia was something like 40,000 years ago, the Americas probably about 11,000 years ago, a whole wave of extinctions followed that, and then Hawaii in 8400, we'll come back to that in a minute. Whales, of course, in the 19th and 20th centuries, many species of whales were hunted to the brink of extinction, and some actually across the brink of extinction. When there are no constraints on harvesting a resource, and it forms part of the needs for society, there seems to be no reason to stop. Another example is bushmeat, and this has been true throughout history, but today as well. And one of the sad examples of bushmeat is the Indri, one of the lemurs in Madagascar. There are a number of species of lemurs in Madagascar. This one was revered as being the sort of ancestor of humans. And the Malagash who inhabit Madagascar have a whole bunch of what are called fadi, or taboos, about a whole lot of different things. And it varies from place to place. But one of the universal fadi is not to eat primates, and especially the Indri. But this fadi appears to be breaking down, and the Indri is rapidly becoming part of the diet, not only for subsistence people, but it's actually being hunted and then sold at some distance away. So it's become part of the market economy as well as just the needs of subsistence people. Did anybody see the movie Madagascar? This won't have much resonance then, but in the movie Madagascar, a band of lemurs is rescued from their enemies, the Fusas, which are a low-slung puma. And it turns out that the Fusas also are being hunted to extinction as bushmeat. There were never any fadi on them, but they were a little harder to catch. Anyway, this is just one of hundreds of examples that could be given about bushmeat. Other examples of over-harvesting are a little more exotic, not the simple needs of people for food. Traditional Chinese medicine requires a lot of very exotic ingredients, and in some cases the sources of those ingredients are being hunted, or for plants, picked to extinction. Another is ceremonial. For example, the Sumatran rhinoceros, of which only 300 of the species still exist, the horn from this rhinoceros is used to make the jambaya, which is a ceremonial dagger for a Yemeni rite of passage ceremony. And when the nation of Yemen got much more affluent with oil production, suddenly, you know, instead of the cheap version of the jambaya, they could buy the real thing from the Sumatran rhino. So that's part of what's pushed the Sumatran rhino to the brink of extinction. Let's talk a little bit more about Hawaii, because Wilson spends a lot of time on it. It's a fairly vivid example of what happens when humans arrive in a new environment. In AD 400, when Polynesian immigrants first arrived, there were somewhere in the neighborhood of 130 unique species of birds found nowhere else in the world. This was an example of one of them, the moa. It was almost an Eden. There were no mosquitoes, ants, stinging wasps, venomous snakes or spiders, or plants with thorns. What a description of Eden. You could walk around and not worry about, you know, being stung or bitten or scraped by thorny plants. But guess what? That didn't last long. Of the original 130 plus bird species, only 35 remain, and 24 of those are endangered. So there are only 11 left that are healthy. There are mosquitoes, ants, wasps, spiders, and thorns in abundance. Of the roughly 2,000 flowering plant species on the islands, half are alien, and they're the dominant ones. They've out-competed the natives. And Wilson said the invasion of Hawaii is an abnormal acceleration of the Darwinian process. A lot of these things, of course, were brought inadvertently. They were stowaways in boats and later airplanes coming to the island. But they were connected with the settlement of Hawaii. Here are two of the biggest culprits in transforming the landscape of Hawaii. The African big-headed ant, and you can see why it gets that name. These ants exterminated most of the native insects of the Hawaiian lowlands, including those that pollinate the native flora. And thereby, their influence percolated up the food chain and sort of wreaked havoc at various levels. They also reduced food for smaller insect-eating birds by killing the other insects. The Hawaiian environment, of course, involved without ants, and as Wilson says, it was unprepared for the shock of occupation by social predators of such high caliber. It was also unprepared for ground-dwelling mammals. There were only two native mammals in Hawaii. One was a bat, and the other was a seal, so neither of them were ground-dwelling. Pigs were brought initially for food, some escaped, and they ran rampant and destroyed vegetation and so on. There are now 42 alien mammals on Hawaiian Islands. Another example of now moving on to habitat, that was the sort of over-harvesting and invasive species. Moving on to habitat, Vancouver Island marmot is down to about 70 wild individuals. You've probably seen marmots if you've gone hiking around higher elevations around here. I saw a couple at Holden Lake on Monday. They're, you know, very, very cute animals. They're a good deal bigger than squirrels, but they're from the same family, and they have this habit of sort of standing on two legs and looking around, which is very endearing. But the decline of the Vancouver Island marmot was a puzzle. Their habitat up in the subalpine areas was essentially undisturbed. The predators were no more abundant. They seemed to have adequate food, and it was a big puzzle. And biologists worked on this for a while, and they figured out that the problem was not their resident habitat, but what was happening below their resident habitat. The way the species has managed to survive is that in every generation there are a few pioneers, the young marmots, who will leave their current habitat. They'll go down to lower elevations, and they'll keep going up in a sort of zigzag pattern until they find a suitable habitat, and then they'll colonize that. They'll dig their burrows. Well, what happened, go ahead, was they would go down and find clear cuts, and they'd say, oh, a meadow. And they'd dig a burrow there, but they were not in the habitat that they were evolved for. And so they've either been eaten by unfamiliar predators, or their hibernation cycle would be thrown off by the warmer temperatures. So this was an example of habitat destruction, not of their habitat, but in a sort of strange way it affected them. One important fact about habitat is that the size of undisturbed habitat determines the number of species that can live there. One way to see this is by considering the number of native reptiles and amphibians on different Caribbean islands, where they started out with a fairly similar exposure to the possible species. Cuba, with an area of 44,000 square miles, has about 100. Puerto Rico, only about 3,000 square miles, has 40. Montserrat, down to Redondo, which is just 1 square mile, has only 5. If you like math, the number of species that a habitat can support goes roughly as the cube root or fourth root of the area. So reducing the area by a factor of 10 to 1/10 of its original will almost automatically wipe out half the species. It's just how this seems to work. In Madagascar, getting back to that example, roughly 1/10 of the original native or undisturbed habitat remains, and so that's played a role in the decline of species there. And of course, that's true in throughout Europe and North America as well. Sort of summarizing some of the key parts of habitat destruction. The tropical rainforests contain half of all known species in only 6% of land area. And it's being destroyed at the rate of roughly 1% per year, which obviously would take about a century to destroy the whole tropical rainforest. Fortunately, there are beginning to be conservation efforts that are shifting this rate of destruction downward. Of course, we Europeans are also to blame. The old growth forests in North America are nearly gone. The last remnants are here in the Pacific Northwest in federally protected lands. Wetlands, of course, fall prey to development. You know, if you're a landowner, you tend to view the wetlands as kind of the worst of your land. It's, you know, it's buggy and muddy, and you can't grow crops on it, you can't build houses on it, so what do? You fill it in. And that's happened at a pretty good clip, but wetlands being a fairly unique environment host a disproportionately large number of species. And likewise, the coastal zone is sort of a unique environment where you have this availability of both land and salty water for different species to exploit. So these are different types of very special habitats that are being destroyed, and not by any means just in the developing world. A lot of this happened with even more vigor hundreds of years ago in Europe. So what have all these problems added up to? The natural rate of extinction from 450 million years ago to the dawn of civilization was an average of 1 species per million per year. This is the sort of background rate of species extinctions. Of course, you probably know about the 65 million year ago event that wiped out the dinosaurs. That's known as the Cretaceous-Tertiary mass extinction, because it happened at the boundary between the geologic age known as the Cretaceous and the current age known as the Tertiary. But this period has been punctuated by several episodes of mass extinction. And at the same time, though, there have been new species forming through mutation and evolution. And so this 1 species per million per year has been roughly balanced. Now, however, the modern rate seems to be something like 1,000 times the background rate, something like 1,000 to 10,000 species per million per year, which obviously is unsustainable and is at the heart of the concern about species loss. So what will happen in the future if we keep going at this rate? Half of all species could be gone in the next century, which is just a stunning rate. But if you take the 10,000 and multiply it by 100, you get a million per roughly a million. So that would be all of them, but clearly we won't keep up at that rate. So what are we actually losing? Most of us probably wouldn't miss some obscure snail in the Amazonian rainforest or some microbe in the soil or whatever. But genetic diversity is the natural capital with which nature produces these new species that sustain life over the long term. And if you remember on Monday, I talked about our role as stewards of the planet, ensuring that Earth could continue to serve its function of providing for the sustenance of future generations, as well as of other plants and animals. It turns out that one of the big concerns about what we're losing is in pharmaceutical applications, and I'll get to some examples of that in a minute. Nature also provides for the purification of air and water and for the cycling of carbon and nitrogen, particularly in the soil. Soil microbes play a big role in cycling nitrogen, for example. And some economists at Stanford several years ago estimated that if you added up everything that nature was doing for us, the ecosystem services amounted to $33 trillion per year, which exceeds the gross world product. In other words, there is a real economic value to what nature does, and I'll show some specific examples of that in a minute. This is probably the easiest one to understand. This is the Catskill Mountains, which provides water for the New York City area. They have a bunch of pipelines feeding the city, but like a lot of cities here on the West Coast, they preserved an area, two areas actually, of forested land to provide drinking water. A number of years ago, though, the water quality was degrading, and they had two options. They could build a water filtration plant for somewhere between $6 and $8 billion, with an annual operating cost of $300 million per year, or they could spend $1 billion in a one-time effort to restore the watershed by buying forested land and upgrading people's septic systems, and they wouldn't have to build a filtration plant. Well, guess which option they chose? The cheaper one. So they did preserve the environment, and this is just an example of the dollar value of services that nature provides. Let's talk a little bit about biodiversity and medicine. I'm going to actually read couple of paragraphs here, because I like the way Wilson puts it. There's an evolutionary logic in the pharmacological bounty of wild species. Throughout the history of life, all kinds of organisms have evolved chemicals needed to control cancer in their own bodies, kill parasites, and fight off predators. Mutations and natural selection, which invent this armamentarium, are processes of endless trial and error. Hundreds of millions of species evolving by the life and death of astronomical numbers of organisms across geological stretches of time have yielded the present-day winners of the mutation and selection lottery. We have learned to consult them while assembling a large part of our own pharmacopoeia. Thus, antibiotics, fungicides, anti-malarial drugs, anesthetics, analgesics, blood thinners, blood clotting agents, agents that prevent clotting, cardiac stimulants and regulators, immunosuppressive agents, hormone mimics, hormone inhibitors, anti-cancer drugs, fever suppressants, inflammation controls, contraceptives, diuretics, antidepressants, muscle relaxants, rubefacients, anticongestants, and sedatives are now at our disposal, complements of wild biodiversity. Revolutionary new drugs have rarely been developed by the pure insights of molecular and cellular biology, even though these sciences have grown very sophisticated and address the causes of disease at the most fundamental level. Rather, the pathway of discovery has usually been the reverse. The presence of the drug is first detected in whole organisms, and the nature of its activity is subsequently tracked down to the molecular and cellular levels. Then the basic research begins. So if you think that drugs come from a bottle which comes from a factory which just makes it out of, you know, thin air or minerals, as I always did. It's just, oh well, you know, they just sort of get the stuff. They just manufacture all the active ingredients synthetically. That is true. They manufacture a lot of these ingredients synthetically, but the origin of a lot of the ideas is in nature itself. So 40% of all prescription drugs are extracted from plants, microorganisms, or animals. 9 out of the 10 leading prescription drugs, at least in 2001, when this book was written, originally came from organisms. I think I was going to make a joke about that.
Go ahead.
It might be a little off color. Well, something about, I think this was before Viagra was probably. But ascomycete fungi, I mean, you think of fungi as just being a little, you know, ick, but they've yielded 85% of antibiotics, starting, of course, with penicillin. And we only know 30,000 species of fungi, and that's probably only 10% or less of the total. Let's look at another example of, or a specific example of these, the way this kind of interaction between drugs and their natural origins and then what we're losing. In the 1970s, John Daly and Charles Myers went to Ecuador to extract some poison from a poison dart frog. There are many different species of these, and they each have different sort of chemical formulations for their poison. They took this particular sample back to their lab and found that in small doses, it works as a very powerful painkiller and one that's non-addictive, unlike a lot of others. And with a little tinkering, the chemists were able to eliminate some of the side effects like sleepiness. So they had this marvelous source for a drug. By the time these guys went back to Ecuador, though, of the two areas of rainforest where this particular frog lives, one had been cleared for a banana plantation. In the remaining one, they were able to find enough of this particular species of poison dart frog to harvest a 1 milligram sample. And that was enough to make the drug. But think how narrowly they missed losing it entirely. So as Wilson puts it, the search for natural medicinals is a race between science and extinction. So what can we do? And I'm now talking broadly about both the biodiversity question and about the sort of the climate change issue that we dealt with earlier in the week. I think in a lot of ways these global environmental issues are intimately connected. The first, and this is not one that you get reading you know, environmental books, but I think comes from the Bible, is to connect with God, to connect with nature, and to connect with each other. I'll explain a little bit more what I mean by that in a moment. The second is basically to consume less. We can think about being efficient, energy efficient, and so on, but a fundamental driver of a lot of these environmental problems is simply that we buy so much stuff, and it requires so much resources to manufacture it, to transport it, and then to dispose of it. And not just to consume less, but to consume more wisely. Think about where things come from, and to, you know, there's a sign in the bookstore, commit to your back-to-school shopping being sweatshop-free. You know, there's great concern about the sweatshop labor, where do things come from? And finally, to be heard. I think that using our voices through writing letters to media outlets or joining environmental organizations or through congregations being active, through writing letters to elected officials saying, you know, these things are important to me. These are all ways to be heard, and this is the, you know, this is a democracy. Our leaders follow the will of the people, and if the will of the people is to treat the environment with more concern, it will happen, and it is happening. Here are some details about what I mean by connecting with God, nature, and each other. The first step, I think, is to repent, to recognize our own role in what is happening. And it's a little harder to do, maybe, than seeing the role that we have in hurting someone's feelings or you know, some other sort of direct sin, but it is wrapped up in how we live that others are paying the price. I think another part of it, and Holden is very good at encouraging cycles of rest, God made a Sabbath rest, and it is in our nature to work hard, but also to need rest. Having a day of Sabbath to not consume, to not go shopping, to connect with other people, to connect with God, is a very important part of becoming the kind of people God wants us to be, and to living in more environmentally sustainable ways. Third, and of course this is very valuable for nature, is just to enjoy and value it. As we come up to Holden, this is one thing we can do, just to go hiking or sit on the deck and looking at the mountains. And then to discuss with others, teach and discuss the care of creation. And finally, to build transformative community. One of the things I like about Holden is the emphasis, and it's a simple fact of where this place is, the emphasis on using every resource very carefully, and trying very hard not to waste food, because somebody in the village is the one who has to deal with waste, and carting it out by truck, or just making sure the septic system is working, and so on. So we're very much more aware of where things come from and where things go here. And we're also aware of the ways that we can share with other people. Our church goes camping every year, and every family is going to forget something. But there's always going to be another family who has that, who has a Coleman stove with an extra burner they can use, or who has a pot, or whatever. And living in our isolated, houses in our neighborhoods, we tend to want to have everything of our own. And, probably not every house needs a lawnmower and an edger and a weed whacker. Maybe through building community we can share some of those things and just not have quite so much stuff. If you've ever been on staff at Holden for longer than a week, you've had the opportunity to do garbology, where you get to see in great detail what kinds of things people are throwing away and thinking about how to dispose of it in the most efficient way. So to conclude this set of talks, but particularly this one on biodiversity, our consumption of resources, and I'm not talking now just about the developed world, but also the developing world, our consumption is driving species extinction at rates that are similar to what happened when the comet struck and wiped out the dinosaur. So that's kind of a sobering thought. We don't even know what we're losing. A lot of these species are too little or too remote to have even been discovered, and we can only postulate that they're going extinct. We have some inkling that the value, the sort of intrinsic value in that God created them, but even the monetary value, for example, to the pharmaceutical industry, could be in the hundreds of billions of dollars. So this is a big deal, even if you're just a sort of cold-hearted economist type. And finally, we do urgently need, particularly to protect these hotspots that have far more biodiversity per acre than the others. And in addition to the tropical rainforest, which is probably the first thing that comes to mind for a lot of people, the coral reefs are the hotspots of biodiversity in the oceans. But also another fairly unusual type of environment is the Mediterranean climate scrublands, which are found obviously around the Mediterranean, in South Africa, Southwest Australia, and Southern California. So development in Southern California is one of the big threats to biological diversity, and these hotspots need to be protected. They have a disproportionate share of the world's species. Something like 1.4% of the Earth's surface is home to almost half of the world's species. So I hope this isn't too depressing. I think that it's such an important issue that we really need to think about it. There's not a lot we can necessarily do in our everyday lives on the preservation of land in hot spots. But it's an issue that definitely needs some pushback to our leaders to make sure that it happens. And the environmental organizations that are working hard to do this clearly need some support as well. That's all I have, and I'd be happy to take questions or comments. Yes?
How about naming some of your favorite, most effective environmental organizations that you're aware of?
Well, that's a tough question. The Evangelical Environmental Network, I think, is playing a key role because it is really attempting to influence evangelicals in this country, which have historically been sort of aligned with right-wing causes. And they've been making some real headway in the last few years. They've gotten some buy-in from leaders of some fairly conservative denominations, recognizing that secular conservatives are really on a different bus, going in a different direction, and that whether or not they think, it's all going to burn, there's a clear role for Christians in stewardship. You may have heard that the EEN did a campaign a couple years ago, a very anti-SUV campaign called "What Would Jesus Drive?" And they got a lot of flack for that, but they did sort of raise the awareness among evangelicals that our consumer choices influence the way our environment functions. And I've had some correspondence with Jim Ball, the director of EEN, and he's really working hard now on the climate change issue, starting with that "What Would Jesus Drive?" campaign. Others, the World Wildlife Fund is working hard, as well as others are, at preserving some of these biological hotspots and rescuing species that are on the brink of extinction. I could list more, but that's probably enough now. They're more listed in the book, 101 Solutions to Global Warming. Yes?
You had mentioned that a lot of species are involved in the pharmaceutical industry and developing medications. Are there environmental groups that work maybe a little bit more hand in hand with industry or businesses to try to preserve?
I don't know that. I seem to recall something in Wilson's book, just a passing reference to an environmental organization being involved in that kind of partnership with the pharmaceutical industry. I don't know whether they are, whether the pharmaceutical industry is actively spending money to preserve habitat in these places.
Well, I mean, it's not just pharmaceuticals, like the logging industry and the spotted owl controversy.
Right.
Or anything where opposing sides maybe work together a little bit to try to find a solution. It seems to me that...
Yeah, well, it's clearly...
There's never going to be a driving force. It's going to have to be...
Yeah, it's clearly in the interest of the pharmaceutical industry to preserve these habitats. And whether they're putting money into it, I don't know. Unlike the spotted owl thing, where it was more, economics versus environment.
Right.
Other questions? Yes, Michael.
Seems like our economy is dependent on consumerism, and if we don't consume, if I don't buy my own lawnmower, I don't buy my own car, I don't buy my own everything else. I'm helping creating an employment. What do you say to unemployed?
Well, that's the traditional view of the function of each human being in an economy. Is that our function is to consume? And you might recall that after September 11th, one of the consoling messages that our president sent was, you should all go out shopping.
Right.
And the automakers obliged by, offering these interest-free loans on cars. And from a purely economic standpoint, that's true. From the long-term sustainability of the planet, it's hard to argue that that's the best approach. And in that book, 101 Solutions to Global Warming, which is in the bookstore, one of the things they advocate is measuring economic success by the gross, what's it called, the GPI, the gross progress indicator. So it includes both economic and non-economic values. And some of the non-economic values are, you know, health, quality of life. And if, when you add those in, even though the economy has been going up, you know, forever, the gross progress indicator actually peaked in the 70s and has been sort of declining. And you know, we kind of feel this in some ways that we're having to work harder than people did a generation ago just to live in the same kind of house. People are living longer, but there are a lot more problems with, you know, loneliness and mental illness. And so there's this sort of tension that, what does it really mean to be better off? And yeah, in the short term, if everybody in America suddenly decided I'm going to consume 10% less, and you know, save, tithe, give to environmental organizations, whatever, that would be a huge economic shock. Over the long term, consuming less, yes, it's going to result in lower economic growth, but when you think about some of the other upsides, you know, what if you reduce your work week from 48 to 32 and you spend that extra 16 hours at home with your kids? You know, it's, you're not making any more money, you're not spending that more money, but your kids will love it. It's that kind of thing.
Yes. To dialogue a little further on that, I think those of us who have a lot tend to consume more than we need to. We have three kids, so we have to have four television sets in the house. You know, one for each kid and one in the television room. Or we have...
plus four cars, ultimately. Or
there you go, not to mention the cars and so on. So there's this thing, I think it's called conspicuous consumption, mm-hmm. which we could work on. And then not just to pat ourselves on the back, but how do you share that value with other people? So those of us who are teachers, for instance, can advocate that in our classroom. If we're pastors or Sunday school people, we can advocate it there by modeling it. That doesn't ruin the economy, but it may equalize some of the inequalities in our society, mm-hmm. not to mention our relationship to the third world or the developing world. Yeah. So I think we have a lot to do, to just look at ourselves, what can I do, how can I love your final notion about, what was it, be heard, and there are many, many ways we need to improve on that.
Yes?
Well, I was thinking about the everybody spends 10% less, consumes 10% less, and then all these people are way laid off, but I think in the long run, I think that's kind of short-sighted in that I would suspect, given traditional American ingenuity, we would discover other uses for the money we're not spending, and those other uses would in turn, because they would be receiving more money, would then be employing more people, and that it would probably balance out, but in a different formula than it is right now. And I don't know, it's hard to say. But I would think that in the long run, not buying things would give people more money to give to, for instance, service organizations, or you know, more money, you know, even spent on non-tangibles like time in Holden, which would then improve the Holden economy, and you know what I mean. But there is a balance there, and I think we're too used to spending, so the money would end up going somewhere, which would then in turn provide employment.
Mm-hmm.
Other comments or suggestions?
We could even recycle a lot more. Yeah. Those of us from Seattle are used to recycling. I mean, when I came to Seattle, recycling was free in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
Didn't have to pay for it even. But, you know, I go around the U.S. and most people I stay with, there isn't much recycled.
Yeah. I know, it just feels really weird to throw away a glass bottle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm used to doing that.
So when people come to my house, it's kind of like I got to tell them, okay, this goes in the green recycle, this goes in the paper recycle, this goes in whatever recycle, because all these people are just totally ignorant.
And I think there are simple things too, in terms of, you know, speaking of things that we can do in our economy. When we got ready to replace our carpet, we bought carpet made from recycled pop bottles, which is wearing wonderfully and cleans infinitely better than wool. And I'm absolutely thrilled with it. And everybody comes into our house is like, and this is pop bottle. It's like, yeah, isn't that cool? You know, yard for yard, it was very comparable price. It was a little more, but it wasn't enough to be daunting. But to look at things like that, you know.
It's not flammable either.
No, but it melts. Oh, we didn't have a spark come out of the fireplace and melt the patch. But it doesn't flame. When we replaced our roof, we put on a metal roof because all the information says that should last much longer than the current composite roofs, which are all going into landfill, you know, every 10 years. And, you know, to look at what might be a more expensive short-term option, but in the long term, may be more effective and just make our houses more efficient. Mm-hmm. And examples.
There are a number of demonstration projects of, you know, homes that are built with cutting edge technology from, you know, from the ground up. They're all completely different, you know, materials, different philosophy. And there's a building at, I think it's Oberlin College, where they designed the whole building from the beginning to be sustainable. And in fact, the whole design process was completely different because they had students involved as well as engineers and designers, and they integrated the building with its landscape. So for example, the water is circulated through a wetlands treatment, and they aren't actually exporting sewage. They've got their own little, you know, natural sewage treatment facility there. And they're just reusing the water. They've got solar panels on the roof, and their goal is to produce the same amount of electricity that they use. You know, as Steve was saying yesterday, with wind it's sort of intermittent. Obviously, the same is true with solar and the
especially
way they're
the Pacific
what they're doing with. But
I said especially in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, this is Oberlin is back in Ohio, I think.
They actually have sunshine.
But the whole philosophy was, we're going to build a building that is an example of what can be done, and I think they use, you know, recycled carpets. And one of their philosophies was create no ugliness. So they were looking at the entire product life cycle of everything that went in. What was required to create this light fixture or this carpet? What kinds of environmental damage did it do? And what are the options for recycling this when it wears out? So they were trying to maximize the total environmental benefit. Another nice thing about it is the landscaping is edible. So they've got all sorts of, you know, berry plants and so on, leafy plants, and they want people to walk around and eat the landscaping.
Great.
To feel, you know, connected to nature. And it's just a marvelous example of American ingenuity tackling these problems in a really wholesome way. And you know, there's a community like that actually being built in Portland. And last year I met a guy here at Holden who works for Methuen, which is a big architectural firm in Seattle. They're one of the leaders in sustainable building. And they built this whole planned community that is supposed to be energy independent and water independent from the rest of Portland. You know, a high density community providing enough electricity through solar and wind to provide the needs of that group of people, and likewise they're going to have the same kind of water treatment and so on. So there's some really amazing things going on.
Yes. And then the economy will shift too, because people will be doing these kinds of things instead of producing more in other kinds of things that destroy the environment.
Yeah.
You know, so there will be some employment in that area rather than saying, well, people will be out of work because I'm not buying this van or whatever.
Yeah, a lot of these things are more labor intensive, so that they do actually provide more employment per house or whatever than the traditional way.
I wanted to say that about 10 years ago, my community did not recycle. And then I wrote a letter, you know, to the mayor, and I was one more voice that he heard. And within 2 years, you know, people were saying the same, and we finally recycled. So now we live in east of Phoenix, and we do have blue barrels. We don't have the, you know, the green. Oh, we have the green and the blue and the black barrels. Yeah. But I think it's a great improvement from where it was 10 years ago. And I think if more community did that, we would save all resources.
There was your last point, speak out. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
One more voice.
Yes.
And in doing so, that probably created more jobs in the community, because
that's right.
Putting it at the curb is just the first start. I mean, there's transporting it, and there's sorting it out, and there's remanufacturing, and there's a lot more going on than just putting it a hole in the ground.
I think we could do a lot more with being more careful of how we use electricity and water, too. You know, I think there's including our own house. There aren't a lot of incentives to be... financial incentives or anything to use less water. In fact, I think if I remember correctly, the utilities, they don't like it if you use less because then they get less water.
The city of Seattle had a bit of a crunch with water in 2001, and part of how they averted it was, I mean, they've always had, you know, demand management. They asked people to conserve water and not water outdoors so much. But they introduced a three-tier pricing system. So, you know, at a certain basic level, the water costs hardly anything per gallon. And then you get past a certain point, and it gets a bit more expensive, you know, something like three times more expensive for the next gallon. And then you get to that third tier, and it's, you know, vastly more expensive. And then they realized that for the richest people, you know, they didn't really care if their water bill was a couple of $100 a month, so they published a list of the worst, you know, water users, or the biggest residential water users in the city. You know, talk about humiliating. And, you know, it's Craig McCaw and people like that, and people with very big estates in Seattle. Whatever works, right?
The city of Seattle also was in need of saving water. Well, it is from time to time as there are droughts, and they handed out door to door water saving shower heads. It was much more cost effective for them to reduce demand that way than it was to build more infrastructure to serve an increasing demand. And the same thing happens in the electric power industry. There's a concept called megawatts, which is kind of a play on megawatts. But if you have increasing demand in a certain utility, you can choose to build another power plant and fuel it and operate it and pay for that, or often it's more cost effective to reduce the consumption through conservation, handing out compact fluorescent light bulbs and other measures to reduce that. Now, that all depends on which utility. I think I have been in places in my travels where the utilities are still real eager to have you install an air conditioner or other things that are going to increase their business. And I think there's a natural reason for them to do that. But in other environments where the utility is faced with a very costly expansion, they would rather have at least the public policymakers that are helping set their rate structures and whatnot are trying to avoid the need for that extra power plant by conservation. So there's different ways to look at it.
I've heard that conservation measures in the Northwest in the last 20 years have eliminated the need for 1,000 megawatts of new power. Does that sound like the right order of magnitude?
Could very well be.
A very large fraction.
Even with that, the population is growing, and there are more power plants going on, so there would have been even more going in.
I had a question about wind from yesterday, and there was a while back where, you know, everybody wanted solar panels on their houses, and I had several friends who bought solar panels that didn't work about 20 years ago. was a big scam in Puyallup anyway. But is wind something that is practical for home use? If you wanted to put in your own windmill, you talked about a high school that had a windmill, and then you talked about them costing, you know, millions of dollars, and I thought, well, that's hard to do for most school districts. Sure. So is there a way to get smaller windmills or to use in a practical
the
backyard kind of
use? Yeah, I should probably explain better yesterday. The business that I was talking about, the wind development and
right.
scales, are much more utility scale, large installations, very costly per unit. And there are applications where solar makes a lot of sense mm-hmm. and wind makes a lot of sense on a small scale, particularly where it's not cost effective to extend a power line to some remote location.
Yeah.
Even in the middle of the city, that's true. The parking meters in Seattle are all solar now because it's expensive to dig through the concrete, run electricity to a bunch of different places, but it put a little solar panel on it and it can power itself. So a remote farm is a good application for solar or wind, but if you're within access to the power grid and it's not very windy at your site, you're going to have a very difficult time with a cost-effective wind installation. Because on a unit basis, the smaller ones become more expensive, a unit of production.
Mm-hmm.
These giant machines, yeah, they cost a lot, but they produce a lot, and scaling them down to a farm or home-sized machine is presently not very cost-effective unless you're quite remote.
I'm sorry, good for holding in the winter is what I was thinking. Is wind, because I know they have wind in the winter when they don't have water running to generate power, and I've been here in the spring where, you know, it's like, don't plug anything in, we're only showering every 2 or 3 days, sort of a thing, because they're conserving so much. Would that be a viable thing for this community?
Potentially, yeah. Up on one of the ridges, probably, and then you'd have to decide whether you wanted to look at it, because it would change the character of how things look around here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly a real impact that you have to balance out. And the wind isn't great right here in the village, I presume. You'd have to be some distance away, so there'd be a cost to run a power line, for example.
Okay. I'm just curious.
Yeah, that's just off the top of my head.
Yeah.
You know, maybe more feasible than that.
As wind was coming into being several years ago, a lot of the suburbs of Minneapolis legislated against them. You couldn't put a windmill up if you wanted to.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Aesthetics or
aesthetics
or whatever.
And you want a windmill, but the rest of your neighbors don't want it.
Yeah, we've got some very fast-growing developments in wind plantations or whatever you want to call them here in Washington. I think almost everyone has faced a lot of opposition from the way it looks. The same is true in offshore areas in Europe where they've considered that Steve can say more about the NIMBY opposition.
Yeah, I mean, aesthetics and noise, particularly in a residential setting, are significant potential impacts. And California did something where at a state level, I'm not sure how they did this, but they mandated that local ordinances had to allow for wind, small-scale wind, up to a certain height. So there's different ways to look at it. If you're against something, there's a lot of impediments that can be thrown in the works, and that a lot of things have been tossed out in the wind business, for example. I mean, I think it's difficult to cite a public library because people don't want traffic or this and that. There's always somebody who can stand up and say, I don't want this here, and here's why. And it's often a long battle to have something positive put into a community or a hillside or whatnot. So it's not easy.
Well, I think we better adjourn. Thank you all very much for coming and for your